needles.
Needles in the red.
That's right.
Needle.
Needle, needle.
Needle.
Needle, needle.
Oh, we'll never find it.
Oh, you're working all right, Nate. Don't give up. Needle, 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 needle. I'm gonna fill you full of glue. Almost got it, not quite.
I know this one.
Almost sounds like a Supertramp song.
Needles in the red, my friend. Needle.
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 Needles in the red, my friend. Needle. All the needle day.
Needle.
Needles in the red.
Needles in the red.
Needles in the red. Needles in the red.
Needle. All the needle.
The reason I'm calling is I want to know,
were you ever in the military?
Thank you.
was the religion that promised me so much. The second was the American experience, which was centered around the business world, the big business, what's good for, you know, General Motors is good for America. And that, too, is a betrayal that what it's not what they said it would be. It's not what they said it would be. We're led about by polls and focus groups. We're first of all polled on what we like, and then they find that out. And if they think they can exploit it, they will. If they can't exploit that, they'll start changing what you like by giving you messages. When they get it to where they know they're in a position to exploit you, they'll do that. And everybody in America is part of this big herd of cattle being led to the marketplace, but not to be sold, as is usual with Catholic, to do the buying. Mm-hmm. To do the buying. And everyone is branded because you see the brands on them. Nike, Puma, Coke, sure. All these brands all over their body. Pretty soon, I think, children, you will go to a family and say, $100,000, if we can tattoo Pepsi on your child's forehead, we'll have it removed when he's 21. Here's $100,000. I mean, I'm sure that the George Washington Bridge will someday be the Ford Motor Company George Washington Bridge. It's just, it's gone beyond what you can merely mock. It's gone beyond what you can merely mock. Folks, this is jerk off time. Don't you see what's happening? What you're doing? What you're participating in? It's what I call the okie doke. Justice is blind. Everyone's equal. The press is fair and impartial. Mm-hmm. It's the American okie doke. It's the official bullshit story. It's the received consensus of reality that we're taught the 4th of July. And it's just not true enough through and through to be accepted on the level that it is. It's this complex of the owners. Gore Vidal calls them the owners, the people who own the country, through their network of clubs, universities, foundations, and corporations that they own, and they're all on each other's boards of directors. They have a consensus that they'd like us to be arriving at. They don't have to have meetings. You know, people say, well, there's no conspiracy. They don't need meetings. They all know what they want. If there's a specific thing, should we have them killed? They'll call each other up. But basically, they know what they want. And it's all them first. And Americans have, for long enough now, I think, been exposed to the exaggerated reality of the experiment here in America, the exaggerated version of it that is overstated and overblown and not quite true, mm-hmm. That they accept it, and then the prosperity makes it easy for them to go ahead and not question things. I mean, you get a good 5-6 year depression in this country, and you'll see some folks out, you know, with torches and shit. I mean, that's what I would love to see. But who's going to do that when you're comfy? Yeah. Everyone's comfy. So I don't know, you know, I don't know much about the American character and what went into it. I know that we're not the same as our European forebears, and I know there's a special quality to the kind of independence and, you know, this feeling of being able to reinvent yourself every few years or so, being able to just keep moving west and so forth. There's a different spirit than the people who made up this place. It's very interesting. It's unique, certainly, but I don't know that I have any qualifications for looking into that. I just see the results and like to pick away at them. If I do learn a little something, it's not enough to make a coherent explanation, as you can hear from the last 2 minutes.
You are your form. You're what you're doing. Now, you think... For some strange reason, I must make that go on as long as possible. And therefore, you think you have an instinct to survive. And so the only thing anybody can agree about today, so far as the discussion of ethical and moral problems are concerned, is that we ought to survive. And therefore, certain forms of conduct have survival value and certain forms don't. But when you say to yourself, you must go on living, you put yourself in a double bind. Because you said to a process which is essentially spontaneous, that it must happen. And the basic form of the double bind, which is imposed upon all children, is you are required to do that which will be acceptable only if you do it voluntarily. So when we say to ourselves, you must go on, the reason is, you see, that we are not living in the eternal now, where reality is. We are always thinking that the satisfaction of life will be coming later. There's a good time coming, be it ever so far away, that one far-off divine event to which all creation moves. Don't kid yourself. As the Hindus have taught us, in the course of time, everything gets worse. It eventually falls apart. Comes Kali Yuga and Shiva at the end, and boom. Which is to say, only suckers put hope in the future. Only suckers put hope in the future.
In the ancient Greeks, it was often said that acting in accordance with reason makes us free. Acting according to the passions makes us a slave. The Enlightenment philosopher David Hume, who will pop up every once in a while in these lectures, had a very interesting reversal of this ancient wisdom. It was the ancient poet, storyteller Aesop, who once said that passions should be the slave of reason. Hume, in the 18th century, said instead, reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions. The passions are not really the monsters that they have often been portrayed to be. It's rather that passion motivates us. Without passion, there's no motivation. It's passions that give the meaning to life. Without passions, life is meaningless. So instead of talking about freedom and reason as necessarily conjoined and passions as equivalent to a kind of slavery, what the existentialists suggest is that we think of our lives in terms of passion. Passions give life meaning, and it's through passionate commitment that we give our lives a particular meaning that it has. It's the distinction between really existing, or what I think we would call living your life to the fullest, and just what Kierkegaard calls so-called existence, sort of just getting through, getting by, going along with the crowd, doing what you're supposed to do, being what is very blandly called a good person. For Kierkegaard, again, existence consists of passionate commitment. Nietzsche, who doesn't use the term much, nevertheless has a very clear idea about the same concept. For Nietzsche, to be truly existing, to really be a person, has to do with taking hold of your own life, realizing what your particular talents and virtues are, falling in love with yourself in a very important way, and understanding that what your life is about is manifesting those virtues, manifesting those talents, passionately self-throwing yourself into the work you do, and as he puts it, again borrowing from the ancient Greeks, becoming the person that you really are. Martin Heidegger has a rather dramatic notion, which he calls thrownness, and the image is that we each get thrown into the world. We don't choose the century that we're born, we don't choose our parents, we don't choose the language we first learned to speak, we don't choose our early friends. And in fact, if you look at a good deal of your life, you realize that it's not something you choose, but something you're thrown into. All this is going to have to be weighed against this notion of existence, the idea of passionate commitment, the idea of personal choice. And what we'll find in all the existentialists is a very delicate balance, or I think better, you might say, a dialectic, a kind of active tension between, on the one hand, this sense of contingency and you are what you are because of things that you had no control over. And on the other hand, you are what you are, or you become what you become because of your personal commitments and choices. And that theme is going to run all the way through. Jean-Paul Sartre, for example, is often misunderstood. He talks about something he calls absolute freedom. And people often think, that means you can do anything you want to do, regardless of circumstance. This is nonsense. And it's only people who have an axe to grind, perhaps against the French, who say such things. The truth is that Sartre is very well aware of the fact that people are born, in his generation, into a world that's filled with war and filled with ethnic violence. And the real question is, having been born into such a world, what do you do with it?
Healing begins. Very tender, very loving. Then the pain starts. Claws slip underneath the skin and tear their way up. Just before they reach my eyes, they dig in. God loves me. I know He loves me. I want him to stop. I can't take the pain, the voices and the pain.
I mean, there's nothing meritorious about being in pain. That's just pure old masochism.
I'm talking about passion. Do you know what that word meant originally? Suffering. The way you get your own spirit through your own suffering.
Chosen self-made. This boy's done that. He's created his own desperate ceremony just to ignite one flame of original ecstasy in the spiritless waste around him.
He's destroyed for it. Horribly. He's virtually been destroyed by it. But one thing I know for sure, that boy has known a passion more ferocious than I have known in any second of my life. And let me tell you something, I envy it. That's what this stare has been saying to me all this time. At least I galloped. When did you? I look at pages of centaurs trampling the soil of Argos, and Outside my window, that boy is trying to become one in a Hampshire field. I sit there night after night watching that woman knitting, a woman I haven't kissed in 6 years. And he stands for an hour in the dark, sucking the sweat off his god's hairy cheek. Then in the morning, I put away my books on the cultural shelf.
My Kodachrome snaps of Mount Olympus. Touch my reproduction statue of Dionysus for luck. And go off to the hospital to treat him for insanity.
Now, do you see? Now, do you see? Now, do you see? Scared.
Feelings are scary. And sometimes they're painful. And if you can't feel pain, then you're not going to feel anything else either. You know what I'm saying? You're here and you're alive. And don't tell me you don't feel that.
Feel good.
It is good. Believe me.
You know.
Because I'm your friend.
My friend? You really my friend? You really my friend?
Equus, walk. Here we go. Here we go. The king rides out on Equus, mightiest of horses. Only I can ride him. His neck comes out of my body. It lifts in the dark. Equus, God's slave. Now the king commands you. Tonight, we ride against them all. The hosts of Bola, the hosts of Jobba, all those who show you off for their vanity, tie rosettes on your head for their vanity. Come on, Equus, let's get them. Trot. Steady, 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 steady. That's it, steady, steady. Cowboys are watching, taking off their Stetsons. They know who we are. They're admiring us, bowing low unto us. Come on now, show them. Canter, canter. And Equus the Mighty rose against all. His enemies scatter. His enemies fall. Turn. Trample them, trample them, trample them. Turn. Trample them, trample them, trample them. Turn. Turn, 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 turn! I'm stiff, stiff in the wind! My mane, stiff in the wind! I'm raw, I'm raw! Do you feel my raw? Feel me on you, on you, on you! I want to be inside you, I want to be inside you!
It's all right, there comes a time. Got no patience to search for peace of mind. Laying low, wanna take it slow. No more hiding or disguising truths I've sold. Every day it's something hits me all so cold. Find me sitting by myself, no excuses that I know. It's okay, had a bad day. Hands are bruised from breaking rocks all day. Drained and blue, I plead for you. You think it's funny while you're drowning in it too. So cold, find me sitting by myself, no excuses that I know.
There are three classes of people in the Western world: the aristocrats, the proletariat, and the bourgeoisie. The aristocrats live on the past because they come of noble family, and they're like potatoes because the best part of them is underground. The proletariat live in the present because they have nothing else. And the poor bourgeoisie live for the future. They are the eternal suckers. They can always open to a con game. So when they find out that really there isn't much of a future, you're going to die, they transpose the future into a spiritual dimension. And they figure this material world is not the real world, but the spiritual world is the real world. And there will be somewhere, somehow, an eternal life for me. a charge to keep I have, a God to glorify, a never dying soul to save and fit it for the sky. Well, and they say to them, what are you going to do there? Well, they haven't the faintest idea. You know that? If you ask theologians about what they think is going to happen in heaven, they just dry up. Oh, we're going to play harps. Heaven is to be in church for always. And they think hell is preferable. There's at least some excitement going on. And you see it in medieval art. You go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York and you see Jan van Eyck's painting of the Last Judgment. Heaven on top, hell below. In heaven, everybody's looking as if, like the cat that swallowed the canary, sitting in rows and very smug. God the Father as president and, oh dear. Beneath this, there's a winged skull like a bat and squirming bodies, all nude, all being eaten by snakes, and I don't know, it's a fantastic thing going on. But in that, you see, Van Eyck had a ball painting that, because in medieval way, it was the only way you could get away with painting nudes. And sexy scenes, sadomasochistic, see? So that's naturally why hell became much more interesting than heaven. So, therefore, this hope for the future is a hoax. It's a perfect hoax. Maybe we will make spiritual progress. Everybody puts it off. Maybe if I work at yoga for 10 years, 20 years, and do this thing, I will eventually make it to moksha, to nirvana, whatever. That's nothing more than a postponement. It's this business of, because you're not fully alive now, you think maybe someday you will be.
There is no future. It doesn't exist. It ain't coming. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. You're our future. The children are our future. There's no such thing, asshole.
Come now, you've never read an actuarial table in your life, have you? Why, they've got 10 volumes on suicide alone. Suicide by race, by color, by occupation, by sex, by seasons of the year, by time of day. Suicide, how committed? By poisons, by firearms, by drowning, by leaps. Suicide by poison, subdivided by types of poison, such as corrosive, irritant, systemic, gaseous, narcotic, alkaloid, protein, and so forth. Suicide by leaps, subdivided by leaps from high places, under the wheels of trains, under the wheels of trucks, under the feet of horses, from steamboats. But of all the cases on record, there's not one single case of suicide by...
He doesn't see it at all as heaven or eternal living or anything. sees it as an ending. No.
Well, that sounds fine to me.
No experience, no love, no nothing. Just endless nothingness.
Well, that just happens to be exactly what I'm looking for.
And it doesn't scare him at all. He finds that comforting, I think.
I'm outlining a new writing project, and 5 months of peace is just what I want.
I find it terrifying, but somehow it keeps me going.
Not for me.
This is tremendously important to think about. We put it off. Death is swept under the carpet in our culture. In the hospital, they try to keep you alive as long as possible, in utter desperation. They won't tell you that you're going to die. When their relatives have to be informed that it's a hopeless case, they say, "Don't tell this to the patient." And all the relatives come around with hollow grins and say, "Well, you'll be all right in about a month, and then we'll go and have a holiday somewhere and sit by the sea and listen to the birds and whatnot." And the dying person knows that this is mockery. Well, of course, we've made death howl with all kinds of ghouls. We've invented dreadful afterlives. I mean, the Christian version of heaven is as abominable as the Christian version of hell. I mean, nobody wants to be in church forever. Children are absolutely horrified when they hear these hymns which say, prostrate before thy throne to lie and gaze on thee. They can't imagine what this imagery means. I mean, in a very subtle theological way, I could wangle that statement around to make it extremely profound. I mean, to be prostrate at once and to gaze on the other hand, see, is a coincidentia oppositorum, a coincidence of opposites, which is very, very deep. But to a child, it is a crick in the neck. And that's the sort of imagery we're brought up with. So the idea of what might happen after death, well, you're going to be faced with your judge, the one who knows all about you. This is Big Papa, who knows you were a naughty boy and a very naughty girl, especially girl, from the beginning of things. He's going to look right through to the core of your inauthentic existence. And what kind of heebie-jeebies may come up? Or you may believe in reincarnation, and you think that your next life will be the rewards and the punishments for what you've done in this life. And you know you got away with murder in this life. And the most awful things are going to happen next time around. So you look upon death as a catastrophe. Then there are other people who say, well, when you're dead, you're dead. Just nothing going to happen at all. So what you got to worry about? Well, we don't quite like that idea, because it spooks us. You know, what's it be like to die? To go to sleep and never, never, never wake up? Well, a lot of things it's not going to be like. It's not going to be like being buried alive. It's not going to be like being in the darkness forever. I tell you what, it's going to be like as if you never had existed at all. Not only you, but everything else as well. That just there was never anything, and there's no one to regret it. And there's no problem. 'Cause it's a bittersweet symphonyless life. Well, think about that for a while. It's kind of a weird feeling you get when you really think about it. Really imagine, just to stop altogether. There's just... no thing. Well, then when you come to think of it, that's the way it was before you were born. I mean, if you go back in memory, as far as you can go, you get to the same place as you go forward in your anticipation of the future as to what it's going to be like to be dead. Then you get these funny ideas that this blankness is the necessary counterpart of what we call being. Now, we all think we're alive, don't we? I mean, we're really here? That there is something called existence? You know, the existentialists, Dasein, Throneness, you know, here we are. But how could you be experiencing that as a reality unless you had once been dead? What gives us any ghost of a notion that we are here, except by contrast with the fact that we once weren't? But this thing is a cycle. 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 Like positive and negative poles in electricity.
I'm a victim of circumstance.
Valentine, God, can he go? Let's go. Star Spangled Banner. Oh, God, I couldn't go. Big Valentine. God, can he go? Let's go. Star Spangled Banner. Oh, God, I couldn't go. Big Valentine. God, can he go? Let's go. Star Spangled Banner. Oh, God, I couldn't go. Big Valentine. God, can he go? Let's go. Star Spangled Banner.
And we gotta go. You have been listening to episode 26 of Needle in the Red by Phineas Narco and the National Cynical Network, titled Sine Fervor Nihilum Est, Without Passion, Nothing. Special thanks to Hal Robbins for title translation and order of appearance. Thanks to Ronald Redball and Alexander T. Newport, The Phil Henry Show character, Austin America, and an anonymous caller with Mark Ed Collard's I Need Your Lovin', George Carlin interview excerpt from Radio Nation with Zombie Nation by Kerncraft 400, Alan Watts in Smashing Pumpkins' Bullet with Butterfly Wings, which you are hearing now, Blue Man Group's Synesthetic with excerpt from the Introduction to the Teaching Channel's What is Existentialism series, music from Peter Gabriel's Passion and Security, with clips from the movies The Last Temptation of Christ, Ordinary People, and Equus, Phineas Narco singing Alice in Chains' MIDI version of No Excuses, Alan Watts again with Talking Your Sleep music by The Romantics, Bill Hicks' clip at the end there, music from Rock You Like a Hurricane by The Scorpions, clip from Double Indemnity with Edward G. Robinson, with Ronald Redball after, Over the Edge clip with clip from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and anonymous caller, Alan Watts again with THX 1138, and sample from The Verve's Bittersweet Symphony. And ending with a Phineas Narco composition with unknown schizophrenic caller and modified version of the Swingle Singer's Cuckoo from Rococo Agogo. The National Cynical Network's home site is at www.nationalcynical.com. Thanks for listening.